Hey, everybody, thanks for tuning in. On this week's episode, I interviewed Bob Burnett of Barefoot Mining. Bob has been on the show before. He did had him on last year. We talked about his article where he discussed Bitcoin mining needing more wild horses, which is, the mid-range size and decentralize it more. So I wanted to have him on as part of, the Bitcoin mining series that we're doing since I'm getting into it. Bob and I are talking about doing some different things in Bitcoin mining, but also I wanted to have him on to just get like the tips and tricks for, new miners. And then we kind of just get deep into the thought process behind mining and a lot of the theories behind it. When's the halving going to happen? Is the halving priced in? All those types of things. So I think you'll really enjoy this conversation with Bob. And I also want to thank Upstream Data. I think I mentioned in the episode that I got a black box, but thank you to Upstream Data. Go to upstreamdata.ca and you can check out more information about the black box. But yeah, we talk about, and we're really trying to spur up. I mean, this is a great opportunity for anyone that's looking to invest into Bitcoin but wants to invest in different ways. It's a you can invest with your KYC free sats. You can invest in a company that's doing mining and maybe doing a smaller operation off of stranded natural gas, which is something that I'm starting to turn my attention towards. So I will tell you guys as we go along in that journey. But yeah, we have stranded natural gas. I live in Western Pennsylvania, so it is all over the place. And having those conversations and making everything work to make sure that we can maximize that and get some Bitcoin mined. So anyways, I hope you guys enjoy it. Thanks as always to the Bitbox O2 hardware wallet from Shift Crypto. Go to shiftcrypto.ch/Bitcoin Made Simple. Use the promo code Bitcoin Made Simple to get 5% off and get yourself a hardware wallet, the Bitcoin only hardware wallet from Shift Crypto. And thank you to Movies Plus. Go to mymoviesplus.com or search Movies Plus in the app stores. There's five Bitcoin docs plus the Natalie Brunell Hard Money Show up there. And you can use the promo code SWAN to get 1 year of Movies Plus for $20. So do that. And thanks as always to Swan Bitcoin for partnering with us and getting that show out there, but also the promo code. And yeah, if you guys have any questions, just email me bitcoinmadesimplepodcast@gmail.com. Thanks. So the picture behind you, I don't think I have asked you about it before,
Yeah.
and we've done several Zooms. So what is that picture?
Yeah.
For this is going to be difficult for the people
So
that are
I'll
just
step
listening,
aside. I
but
don't know if anybody. Wait, do I gotta go this way? So, this is a picture from Bitcoin 2022 in Miami, and was in the Wentworth region there,
oh,
and
okay.
there was a large mural painted, and they had a lot of cartoon characters. So this is, Simpsons and I don't what was the
Scrooge
Duck
McDuck.
McScrooge? Yeah, Scrooge McDuck.
And he's holding the
So we got the
Bitcoin.
laser eye Simpson. And then right there, that's my wife actually.
Oh, nice.
Right in front of it. Yeah. So she's a Bitcoiner too. Very passionate Bitcoiner. As well, and she's in
Yeah.
the fitness industry, so loves getting her picture taken actually. So
Especially at a Bitcoin event, right?
yeah, but I love the color, I loved the bee, I love the laser eyes,
Oh yeah, no, that's really cool. It's funny
it
because
was
now
really.
that you say it was at the conference, I'm like, oh yeah, I remember that. But like just getting that little part of it, I was like, wow, did somebody like make that? Or like thought maybe you had like somebody paint that up for you or something.
No, no, no. We just used what was there.
Yeah.
So it was really cool. I don't know if it's still there. I got actually going to Miami next week for Mining Disrupt, which is a big mining conference. And
I know I'm having FOMO now because I didn't even know this conference existed until I talked to Steve Barber. And then I started looking at him like, oh my God, I should have been going. I should have been going.
Yeah, I'll be seeing Steve there and
Yeah. He, it, it, it there's it looks like some crazy stuff that's going to be there.
Yeah, well, it what happens, I think mining is kind of interesting, I guess, since we're talking about this, in that I think in most Bitcoin conferences, and I go to several through the year, it gets relegated to kind of a corner. And, you know, there may be a state. I speak frequently at these kind of events, but, you know, we never get the main stage. We never get the,
No, it's not the sexiest part of the business, that's for sure. It should be.
Well, I mean, that's a matter of taste for me. Yeah. It is, but
the people that have never turned on an S19 or, you know, a What's Miner and seen it actually come.
Yeah. Well, there's something exciting about that. And I think there should be more, frankly. I think it is it's the heartbeat of what we do. We have nothing without the miners, right? You know, and whether you're a guy running, a 1S9 in your garage or you're a bigger commercial operation, part of that. And, what happens approximately every 10 minutes is the essence of what we do. And, the monetary system is controlled through that. And I think at a minimum, I talk to a lot of people, and I think a lot of people, even pretty ardent Bitcoiners, have a very cursory level understanding of mining and how it works, the issues that miners face, vulnerabilities and issues that it will face. I think I see people spew some of the mantra like, well, it it's important because it stabilizes the grid, or I think a lot of times there's a lot of people talking about things they really don't understand, and
I'm finding that out myself, because there was a lot of basically boilerplate statements that I said beforehand, and now here I am, like 3 months into Bitcoin mining and talking. I think like 50% of my podcasts over the last quarter have been basically mining focused, and I'm like, man, I didn't really know what I was talking about. Like, and I it's gonna be a long time before I know what I'm talking about. But it's kind of like the article that I wrote for Bitcoin Magazine about like the understanding Bitcoin, and like you're gonna think you know it all right away, and then you're gonna slowly realize, oh, I don't know anything. So with the mining, I'm trying to keep my mouth shut and just sit here and learn, because there's a lot of nuance to it. And but I do love the fact, I tell people all the time, the one thing I do know is it is amazing to have that machine running and then just look and be like, wow, that is sending like no KYC sats directly to a wallet. And like, all I have to do is turn that machine on.
Yeah. That's phenomenal. And there are things about the network that, like, here's an example. people think a block gets processed every 10 minutes. That's not true. In fact, it's honestly never been true. The number of blocks mined at 10 minutes is minuscule. It's purely chance that, I might be slightly behind, so people out there bear with me, but the last time I ran the numbers, the average block time since the beginning was 941. Now, that was I probably ran that early this year. Okay. So 9 minutes and 41 seconds. So, well, why is that? Well, it's because basically the difficulty adjustment is, it's a backward looking adjustment. So it says, hey, in the previous 2016 blocks, what was the average time? Well, on the whole, the network has been growing, right? Mm-hmm. So when it looks back, it constantly underestimates the next 2 week period or the next 2016 blocks. So that means it comes faster. So I think if you pull the math, forgive me, anybody out there that actually runs the numbers right now, maybe I'm off slightly, but what it really means is that on average, about 150 blocks a day get processed. Have gotten processed instead of 144. So if you do 10 minutes times, which is 6 times per hour times 24 hours, that's 144. So that would be the normal blocks in a day. But because we've been running a little hot historically, it's actually about 150 blocks a day. But here's an interesting thing. We've just had 3 negative difficulty adjustments in a row.
All kinds of factors, price being down, the Texas heat, you know, there's different yeah. factors. And so what's that done? Well, it's slowed it down. So we've actually been, so when you see a negative difficulty adjustment, what that also means is that in that 2016 block period, it less per day are getting processed, and it might be, you know, 130, 135. And so what's kind of interesting is, again, these are like we're talking down kind of a layer to probably where most people think, but it's really not every 10 minutes. And the ramifications of that in the grand scheme of things aren't huge, but the network's constantly kind of speeding up and slowing down. And right now it's slowing down. And so just as another, you know, ramification, now I expect these negative difficulty adjustments are going to end, and the network will global hash will start increasing again.
Mm-hmm.
So, but about a month. So I have a calculator that I've developed myself where I predict global hash rate. And so for me, I predict the next halving at the very end of March. Because I actually think we're going to see a fair amount of recovery, and then we're going to accelerate. We're going to see more than the 150 blocks a day, even probably be like that. Well, mm-hmm. every time that happens, it's moving forward the halving, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now others, and I respect other people have other algorithms. Other people think it could be as late as early June. So, you know, and I think they're taking kind of more the present rate that it's running at and kind of projecting, you know, maybe not much growth and kind of some actually some reversals, right? So if
people shutting down and less miner or
right and so that moves the halving out. So but I'd say, you know, the halving somewhere in that window, the end of March to the early part of June. But if you're in the Bitcoin business, that's a pretty freaking important date, right?
Yeah. Oh,
so you know, you're and so as a miner, if you already have your equipment up, I guess it doesn't really matter, because you're going to be part of mining those blocks, whether they're coming fast or coming slow.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're a guy who hasn't got his equipment up yet, right? So you haven't mm-hmm. started, you're really rooting for that June date because you want as much time
as possible to get in there.
Possible. Uh-huh. So there are, you know, again, we're kind of like things that probably only miners think about at, you know, when you get down another level, but, you know, big deals, like, cause when, you know, when you're looking at the ROI on an investment, and I know you personally, you know, are involved in some things now, those affect your pro forma. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we can speculate, by the way, too, on what does it mean for price?
Yeah.
Because, personally, I think that the halving has a big, big deal on price, and that we don't have to actually get to the halving to feel the effect of the halving.
Mm-hmm.
That the market reacts psychologically, like it does to a lot of things, like just like if the Fed says if people think the Fed is going to raise rates or lower rates at the next meeting, the market starts reacting now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we live in this world where people, you know, what is that, you know, buy the news, or how does it work?
Yeah. Buy the rumor, sell the news.
Yeah. There you go. Buy the rumor, sell the news. And I think it's kind of that same thing for us, that I think people know the halving is a big deal. And so you'll start seeing acceleration as soon as it gets close. And I guess, you know, we'll see what close is.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's, let's say I'm right, late March of 2024, if that's the halving point, then maybe we'll see, I don't know, the summer of 2023, we'll start people saying, well, I'm gonna buy Bitcoin now because I expect there to be a spike at the halving, mm-hmm. but it moves not the actual having itself, but it moves the effect of the having earlier and earlier.
Earlier and earlier, yeah. Because people, I mean, as soon as the FOMO kicks in and they start, it starts ramping up. It's interesting to think about, because so when people say, is the halving priced in? You know, if you're on Bitcoin Twitter at all, you probably hear that a lot. What exactly, explain it in your terms, what that means, because I mean, I think I have my understanding of it, but I don't think I could explain it well enough. So how do you explain it? And I'm not saying whether or not you agree if the halving is priced in, but you know, the theory behind it. And then I'd like to know what you think.
Yeah. Well, first, I guess, you know, why does the halving matter? Maybe, you know, and then, you know, the halving matters because right now the miners, it will go back to the 10-minute block times. If there were 10-minute block times, and they're approximately right. That means that 144 times a day, 6.25 Bitcoin are being paid to the miners as a reward for their efforts, excluding fees. But those 6.25, the material part of that is that that's new coins in circulation, new currency in circulation because of that, versus the fees, which are coming from money that was already in circulation, right? So when the halving comes, we'll go from typically 900-ish per day to 450 per day. So there are a lot of people, myself included, that believe that the Bitcoin price is heavily dictated by the cost of production. Now, I also believe that, you know, just basically it's, you know, it's not 100% cost of production, nor is, I think, it exactly 100%, I guess, just market price subjective. They normally call it like marginal utility, or I think it would be the economics term, right? So I think the price is heavily influenced by the cost of production, because effectively what it means is that, like if you look at it from a stock to flow kind of perspective, and I'm not saying stock to flow like as a price prediction model, but stock to flow as a mechanism in the as a moderator of the money supply, it now means that inflation just cut in half, the money supply is increasing by half. And it means that in my mind, it means that all of the Bitcoin that's already been mined effectively increases in value as a result by that slowdown. So, you know, it's a complex thing. I don't think it's any one thing, but bottom line is there are also arguments within the industry, you know, what is the current cost of production like for Bitcoin? Some people might say it's $8,000 to $10,000. I personally would put it more in the mid to high teens right now as typical cost of production. We can talk about that a little bit later, but effectively that just doubles overnight, right? When the halving hits, boom, that doubles overnight. So if you believe, that's my long-winded way of saying, if you believe that cost of production is a significant player in dictating the market price, well, it doubled overnight. Therefore, I guess, you know, the logical extension would be, well, the price should double overnight, or and if it was well, we'll just leave it there. So when people say this is the halving priced in, this is kind of what I was getting at before. You know, at some point we know give or take, let's say that 2.5 month window that I talked about when the halving's coming. That's what's really unique about Bitcoin. You know when that's coming in a pretty tight window.
Mm-hmm.
And if you believe some semblance of what I just said, that the cost of production doubles and it affects the price, well, if you're not a miner, the other way to play the game would be to buy Bitcoin early ahead of it and sit and wait. So this will be the fourth halving. So I think we're at a point where it's not going to sneak up on anybody anymore.
Right? Yeah. I didn't even know what the halving was until the day came last time. I had no idea. Yeah. I understood. Oh yeah, they're printing money. This is a mess. Okay, Bitcoin does make sense. There's only 21 million. And I remember waking up and going on Twitter and seeing, like, I think it was Pomp, like, posted happy Bitcoin halving day. And I was like, what? All my Bitcoin's getting cut in half? Like, I thought the value, yeah, you know, what the hell is going on? And then I was like, ooh, that's a pretty cool feature.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal feature. And it's, you know, part of the brilliance of the algorithm is right there. But, you know, it goes back to a fundamental tenet of Bitcoin. We have a system whereby we know exactly what's going to happen with the money supply. And, you know, by block at least, and we can extrapolate within pretty reasonable time frames, you know, when in real time, right? Because there's blockchain time or the time chain, you know, and then there's real world. In reality, it's tied to the time chain or the blockchain, but we can extrapolate it to the real world because the bounds unless there's some sort of absolutely catastrophic thing, the algorithm adjusts. So if we lose a phenomenal amount of hash rate, like happened in the China situation, then the block time goes from 10 minutes, 9.5 to 10 minutes in that range to 16 to 20. It slugs through that 2016 set block. Another subtlety a lot of people don't know about is that the maximum adjustment is 25% though. Mm-hmm. So it won't adjust radically.
You're not to respond have that
to one time. It'll take a couple difficulty adjustment cycles, you know, to get there if it's sustained. Because if it's not, I think Satoshi, obviously love to have a conversation with Satoshi, but you know, what was he thinking? But I think in that part of the algorithm, the thought process was, well, there certainly could be a series of events where for a short period of time, you could lose a lot of hash. But then if you make the difficulty adjustment and then it all comes back too quickly, you can get a race where the blocks are coming too fast. They're essentially empty because, you know, there's if there's
no transactions, the process.
Right. Because, well, just imagine a situation you have X amount of hash, doesn't matter, right? You lose 90% of it. Now, you slug through and you get through, you make the difficulty adjustment, but you decrease by a factor of 9, right? Mm-hmm. And so make it that much easier. And then, boom, all the hash comes back online because maybe it was just ERCOT was out or, you know, something like that. And now it's back. And now what happens is the blocks, instead of coming every 10 minutes, are coming every minute and a half. Well, there's not enough transactions to fill those blocks. And so the money supply is being increased and nothing's happening, right? I mean, this we're about proof of work, but I think a component of that, part of the work part that Kissinger talked about, is transactions are getting added to the chain, and that's not happening. Because if that let's say that happens, then in that situation, then you revert, then you'd adjust back to the 10 minutes, right? And that might happen in 4 or 5 days instead of you know, in 2 weeks. So the good news is it wouldn't last forever, but the 25% adjustment helps a little bit
mitigate
in that situation. Now there's a, I wrote an article in February for Bitcoin Magazine. You and I may have even talked about it in a different one called Satoshi's Heel, which is if you get into the really gory details of this, there are some vulnerabilities that the network has to watch out for, where so anybody that's interested in it, Bitcoin Magazine, search my name and Satoshi's Heel, and you'll find the article if you really want to get into the
numbers.
I'll post
it.
But it goes something like, you know, yeah, thanks. But it goes something like this. Imagine a world where the mining network got super centralized. Let's say there's 40 sites in the world, most of them in a place like Texas or a given location, you know, a given kind of geographic proximity. And they represent 99% of the hash. Now, some event, this could be a natural disaster, it could be a government takeover, it could be an act of terrorism, there's a variety of different scenarios, knocks all of that out at once, and it does it right before or right after a difficulty adjustment. So meaning that basically you're 2016 blocks away from creating an adjustment, and you've just lost 99% of the hash. So instead of 10-minute block times, you're going to have like, or I'm going off the top of my head, it's in the article, but let's just say for argument's sake, 18-hour block times.
Mm-hmm.
And let's also say that the what I call the rabbits, you know, the small, medium-sized guys and the horses, they've already been essentially put out of business, right? There's mm-hmm. nobody else out there. Well, there's not even a little bit of hash to come back and fill the gap. So what happens is those 2016 blocks, instead of taking 2 weeks, approach a year to get through. And no transactions are being processed and added to the chain in that time. And so if you then think through, well, you know, what happens with exchanges? It means, you know, people can't get money off of exchanges. Another reason mm-hmm. not to have money on your exchange, right? But,
yeah,
you know, you could have money on exchanges. You can't close a Lightning channel. You can't, obviously, you and I, if I wanted to buy your car, Corey, you and I, you know, we might have to wait forever to
get the confirmation
through. And I think it's not that the network was failing. I mean, all the same, the integrity would be there. The transactions would be occurring. They'd just be occurring so slowly. And if as a network, the world was counting on Bitcoin as a base layer, a monetary mm-hmm. system, or it was a global reserve asset or things like that, then that would be, obviously it would just kill the world's
economy everything.
Right? Yeah. So I bring this up. I think it's a highly, highly improbable situation. Like
mm-hmm.
It's up there with a sunspot, you know, taking us out, or an asteroid hitting the earth or something like that. But it's non-zero, but it's a non-zero chance of happening. And so I wrote the article, and I even talk about it now, just because it's entirely preventable. All we have to do is have just a little bit. This is in the article too, but basically my calculation says if we just have like 15% of the hash, ideally 30, but even 15% of the hash in the hands of the rabbits and the horses and the plebs and the, you know, folks out mm-hmm. there, we're fine. You know, the network, it would suck for a difficulty adjustment or two, but those mm-hmm. difficulty adjustments, maybe instead of being 2 weeks, might take 30 days. you know, we'd get through it, I guess. But
yeah, we'd adjust, and that's so the healing is all from the 25% limit. You're suggesting?
No, actually, it starts working. In that case, it works against you.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because the hash isn't coming back. So it's probably a scenario. Satoshi, that's why I'd love to talk to him, among other things. But I'd like to say, hey, did you think about this one? You have this scenario.
Yeah, did you play this one out?
Yeah. And I mean, it's all the game theory stuff. But I believe that, he made a brilliant system. I don't think anything needs to be changed. I don't think it should be changed. I think the scenario he protected against, which is a lot of hash coming off, but ensuring that we don't make too radical of adjustment because it probably will come back on quickly, is a better, more likely scenario than this massive centralization and then it's down for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
But, I do think... And I think Corey and I have talked about this before. What I call the elephants, which are, the big sites, the 50 megawatt, 100 megawatt, 200 megawatt, 400 megawatt.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay if there's a few of those sites out there. It's still not what I would do, but, the companies doing them have the right to do it. And in individually or a handful of them, they don't matter much, if they represent. But one of the reasons I call them elephants is while they're big and powerful, they're also easy to hunt. And, versus the reason I call the rabbits, like maybe the thing you're trying to do personally, you puts you as a rabbit, you're actually getting to be a bigger rabbit, but, uh-huh. But a rabbit nevertheless. So, rabbits are harder to hunt than elephants, and there's a whole bunch of them. Even if you shoot a couple rabbits, what have you really done? Nothing, right?
Uh-huh.
But you shoot a couple elephants and I think they're targets.
They become endangered real quick.
Yeah. And there's a Senate testimony. Elizabeth Warren but asking questions to the Secretary of Energy, Granholm is her name, I believe, May 20th. Anybody that wants to look it up, maybe I can provide you a link for the show notes too, Corey.
Yeah.
And she said to the Secretary of Energy, she said, I'm going to read it to you because it's phenomenal. But basically what she's doing is really foreshadowing that she's coming for these people. And
she's coming for the elephants.
She's coming. Yep. She is coming. And let's see. It's right there. So I'm actually even I'm looking it up. I'm even a little concerned right now about, what's coming with these executive actions from the president. Is he coming for us?
Yeah. I mean, those are coming today, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But let me read you this real quick. Just a very short thing. Question from Senator Warren directed to Secretary Granholm. Senator Warren, does the federal government currently know how many crypto miners are operating in the U.S. and how much energy they are consuming? Response from Secretary Granholm. No, the DOE does not explicitly track electricity consumption associated with cryptocurrency operations, and I would love to work with you on making sure this happens. So, I mean, it's a straight admission that we are on their radar, that we have, a powerful senator and the Secretary of Energy saying, no, we want to figure out who you people are. We want to know who you are, where you are, and how much you're using. Hmm. Obviously, there's only one of two reasons to do that. Either we want to turn you off or we want to, tax you, right? Neither one sounds very appealing to me.
Or even right.
I mean, I think it's ethically and morally wrong.
They can go pound salt for all I'm concerned. I mean, you can't just the amount of control that they're trying to get over people is insane. And, you know, I don't like what happened with the Texas grid. I don't see that as a good thing. That, like, I think the miners should have been compensated for turning off. You know, be like, you know, instead of making it like, oh, hey, oh, yeah, you need energy? Sure, we'll shut off. Like, you need energy? Okay, we'll sell it to you. Like,
yeah, I think some of them do have that arrangement.
They do,
Corey.
Okay.
I think they do get compensated for when they're off.
Well, that's good.
But not all of them. And, you know, I'm certainly not going to sit here and say, hey, if there's a choice between directing power to the ICU or a nursing home, that, you know, directing it to a Bitcoin miner or, you know, a warehouse or, you know, whatever is not appropriate. I don't have any problem with some a little bit of prioritization there.
Mm-hmm.
But as you said, I think there should be compensation when that happens. And what I really am afraid of, though, is when people like Elizabeth Warren start making lists, and we don't have to go down it, but just think about in history what happens when governments start making lists of people.
Yeah. You know,
and
it doesn't end well.
Yeah. It just doesn't end well, right?
I mean, we've seen that with everything with COVID, and, you know, yeah. I mean, there was I saw a video of a woman, older lady who was vaccinated, unable to get into Canada because she didn't have the app to scan the QR code. So she had to quarantine for 14 days just because she didn't have the scannable barcode that they eventually want to tattoo on your body, I'm sure. You know.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We know that's funny.
That is the part that scares me a little bit. But ultimately I think the United States is set up in a way to hopefully preserve that. The jurisdictional arbitrage, and, you know, if they become a mess in one place, go somewhere else.
Yeah, I think that's the preserving the integrity of state rights, you know, has never been more important. Mm-hmm. And I believe that power is a big deal. There was an EPA ruling last month, or not an EPA, a Supreme Court ruling on this. It was a case, state of West Virginia against the EPA, and it didn't get a lot of publicity, but I'm not sure why. But basically the EPA was trying to come in to West Virginia and dictate standards about power production and clean air standards and things like that. And the state of West Virginia challenged it and said, no, we have the right to make our own decisions about how we're going to produce power and what the standards are. And they won, thank God, because if they hadn't won,
that would have set a bad precedent.
It would set a bad precedent that no, the federal government can come in, because it related around coal plants, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can dictate, you know, yourself whether that's good or bad. I'm not making a statement on that. What I'm making a statement on is that I think individual states should have the right to determine what means of power production are appropriate for their state.
Mm-hmm.
And what safeguards, you know, where, you know, what standards make something clean or dirty? Because, you know, it comes, you may have heard this on it, if you extend that same thing kind of to an international level, for Western countries who have a certain standard of living to go to a third world country who's just trying to bring its people up and say, well, you can't produce, you have to produce power with solar and wind, let's say, and you can't use any of these fossil fuels, when those are much more efficient means of providing energy to their people.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty big moral judgment. I mean, you know, that I believe, and I'm sure they will believe as a sovereign country that, no, we're going to make that decision ourselves. And if the carbon footprint increases because of it, or we have to live with a certain level of air quality or, you know, whatever, well, hell, they have people burning wood in their backyard for, you know,
for heat.
For heat and to cook their meals. So, mm-hmm. you know, this is an improvement. You can't force us to these less efficient, higher capital expense forms of energy production.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that same thing extends to the states. Like, that's, you know, the unique construction of the United States is that same argument applies, I believe, at the state level. And, you know, and then at an individual level, for the government to track, so, you know, you're a miner now. So now, if you're off, part of the reason I'm a big advocate of off-grid is because of some of the things we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say you're a home miner on grid. Well, how would you feel if the government at stage one comes and says, well, you know what, you're consuming 10,000 kilowatt hours per month doing Bitcoin mining and 3,000 kilowatt hours doing everything else. We're gonna charge you 2x the rate on the 10,000 that we would on the 3,000. Because we've determined that is a abuse of the system and it provides no good. Well, you know, next year, they might decide Christmas tree lights should fall in the same category.
Mm-hmm.
And then microwave ovens and then pool heaters, soldering irons. Like where's the
hot
line?
Water you tanks, know? You know?
Yeah. Hot water heater is a great example. If you
furnaces.
Don't need that. Yeah. Yeah. Where? So
get your government sponsored blankets, you know?
Right. Right.
You don't need
so
a furnace.
I think you can't. Yeah. So that's the scary shit. That's why I get passionate about it. There's a new organization that I've endorsed and I'm on the board of advisors called the Satoshi Action Fund, led by Dennis Porter. I was on a meeting yesterday with a lot of other, you know, people passionate about this from other mining companies like Bitfarms and, you know, people with government lobby backgrounds, people like, Foss and Greg Foss and Lawrence Lepard, you know, but we're all trying to fight this. Mm-hmm. And I think the way I say it is, I think what we have to do is you don't want the fight to be, I'll say this to all of you, because all the people listening, because you'll end up in a fight at some point with somebody about this, right? About mm-hmm. boiling the oceans. And I think stay away from trying to argue about whether or not proof of work is better than proof of stake, whether or not Bitcoin uses too much energy or not, and make the argument about right to use the outlet in your house or your business as you see fit. You know, do you want somebody else to decide what the appropriate use of that energy is? And if you're arguing with somebody that believes that a central authority should have that right, then you're going to lose the argument. You're not going to lose the argument, but you're not going to make any headway. If you can convince them that, hey, this thing could go anywhere, you know, are you part of, you know, like, is, I know in certain areas of the country, like, there's always that neighborhood that has all the Christmas tree lights. Like, you know, if you take your kids for the ride, like, you know, okay, well, you know, you may find that really cool. And I, you know, I have young grandkids now. To take them on a ride through that, that's exciting. Like, you know, mm-hmm. so how do you measure the value of that memory and that experience for them against the electricity consumption? I'm not capable of that. And as you said, Do any of us need hot water for our shower?
Nope.
Nope. We're all perfectly fine without it, right?
Yeah.
In fact, you could probably even argue there's health benefits of taking that cold shower.
Uh-huh.
But you know, if you're willing to say that not using the electricity to do that, or energy, some of them are gas heaters, but not using that energy to do that is the best thing because it stops global warming or it does whatever. You know, I guess good luck to you, but me and that person are never going to agree.
And where does it stop? You know, like you mentioned, you know, prioritizing energy towards, you know, nursing homes and stuff. So if the government can dictate what you plug into a wall, then they could come and say, hey, I know your parents are using that life support, but we got to pull the plug.
Yeah.
And that's a really grim example, but you know, I don't think you and I are under any delusions that the government gives a crap about us in the general population.
No. I don't think they give a crap about global warming. I'm not going to argue with somebody about, you know, we're going. I think what they want is control.
Yep.
And that these are mechanisms for control. And by the way, it extends. So the other thing is, so we talked about the outlet. There's a second piece, which is a Bitcoin mining system server is just a computer running software. That's all it is.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody is going to dictate what software you can run on your computer, that a proof of work software running, you know, the algorithm we use is not appropriate, but the software managing a proof of stake validator is okay, then is PowerPoint okay, but Excel isn't? Is the video editing software not okay, but the, you know, whatever, you know, whatever Notepad is, it doesn't matter. But I mean, I think it gets into things that just cost way, way into our personal liberties. And governments, you go to the Patriot Act, you go to, you know, I mean, the Patriot Act, temporary, but most of the measures of the Patriot Act are still in place. You look at the Bank Secrecy Act of 1970, which, for mm-hmm. instance, it's the reason that there's $10,000 limits on cash withdrawals. And but not that you can't do it, but you have to report and have all this record keeping. Haven't changed that number in 52 years. Nixon, when he took us off the gold standard, was supposed to be temporary. If you read his speech, that was a temporary measure.
Temporarily suspend the convertibility of the dollar.
Yes.
Into gold.
Correct.
And nothing, yeah. I mean, one of the best lines is nothing is so permanent as a temporary government measure.
Yeah. Yeah. It's beautiful.
It's, yeah. So. You know, I mean, ay, ay, ay. Yeah.
Anyway. I am, by the way, I am writing an article. I'm not done with it yet. I'm not exactly sure when I'll finish, but on this very topic that this is the top of my list I don't know, for lack of better, you know, issues affecting Bitcoin. I'm more afraid of this than I am of anything. And so, mm-hmm. you know, I'm putting
your energy for
my energy to... and you know my whatever you call my evangelism my whatever you know to fight these people because I do not trust any of them. I don't think they're doing it for the right reasons, and I think that again, getting drawn into it, when I see people get into those arguments of, well, no, Bitcoin's actually good for the environment, and no, Bitcoin helps stabilize the grid, and no, Bitcoin proof of work is way better than proof of stake. They're all true statements, by the way. I'm not mm-hmm. telling people they shouldn't know that, but those are the secondary arguments, you know.
Yeah, that's letting them bring the fight to you.
Exactly.
It's much better to pick the time and place than for it to just show up on your doorstep.
Yep.
Well, hopefully it continues to stay free. I don't doubt that they're, as this goes on, they'll kick and scream and make it a mess and try and, they're like children. Like they just, if they can't get their way, they just flip out, lose their mind. You know, children are better behaved than them.
Yeah, well said. Yeah.
Well, I'm curious. I wanted to ask you about, so like we kind of talked about it, but like, will hash rate meet the price? Because, or, and how much does that dictate where the price bottom is? Because when I bought my miner, it was gonna, at 11 cents a kilowatt, it was gonna make a profit of like $270 a month. Currently, I think last month it made a profit of like $20. So, you know, we're getting close to that number. And now at the same time, you know, I'm a hodler, so I'm not converting it into cash. Yeah. So it's just kind of opened some theories in my, or maybe let me experience theories firsthand where I'm like, you know, if you're hodling, then this should actually drive the price up, and miners selling coins at the top might actually do the opposite. So it like sets the bottom, maybe it sets the top too, because you're like, hey, we were, you know, we have some huge, you know, expenses to pay off. I don't know. I'm just curious.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, interestingly, I think we talk about the public miners for a minute, not all of them, but some of them were forced to sell at the bottom.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm not being critical of anybody, like I said, but I, you know, it's always been a concern of mine that this would happen. Mm-hmm. Because in June, it was Core that had roughly 8,000 Bitcoin coming into the month and left the month with 1,000. And I'm not saying specific to Core, we'll just say this in general. Some of the mining companies have, they've leveraged their mining equipment for loans. So it has somewhat of the same effect as people that have bought Bitcoin on margin, you know.
Yeah, those loans need serviced.
Those loans need to be serviced. And so if the, let's say they bought mining equipment using leverage last fall, early winter, when prices were very high, then, you know, and maybe they got a 50% loan to value ratio, mm-hmm. 30% loan to value ratio, you know, that they had on it. But then, you know, we go from 60,000 to 20,000 and they've lost, you know, and the mining equipment fell at least in parallel with it. Well, they got a big problem, right? You know, mm-hmm. Now they don't have enough money, that loan to value ratio. Some of them also had made commitments, long-term commitments to buy mining equipment back in those time frames and locked in prices. And normally they're buying way less than the plebs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that may have shifted a little bit here, where they were on a long-term contract, something they locked into, and they have to buy X number every month, right? They're coming by contract.
They were thinking that the price was going to keep pumping, so they're getting a discount.
Yeah. And now, you know, that bill is coming. Now they're not really getting positive returns on their mining revenue. And, you know, they do what anybody else did. Well, you got a sick, you know, the way that they're organized. And if what they haven't done in terms of treasury management, have done things like, you know, bought some puts, you know, got some puts, or, you know, got some downside hedging,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, to my knowledge, few of them have done. But anyway, that's the bottom line is they have to pay, right? You know, and so you end up with a group like Core, which I'm sure didn't want to sell 7,000 Bitcoin, but had to sell 7,000 Bitcoin. And, you know, happening in parallel with Luna and Celsius and Voyager, and now we know Tesla's out there. All yeah. that shit is happening, you know, simultaneously. And it just, you know, it's hard. You know, we're not a huge miner. We're pretty, you know, we're bigger than, I say, you know, we're bigger than small, but we're definitely not big enough to be big.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And, you know, but it, you know, same as anybody else, our revenues are down. We're keeping our head above water. We're still profitable, but dramatic change.
Oh, you know, yeah.
In our situation. And we have bills to pay. You know, we've had to sell a little bit, you know, mm-hmm. didn't want to, but we've had to sell a little bit. However, there's opportunity too, that these prices being down on the mining equipment are an opportunity. So if you can come up with the cash, what a great time to buy.
Oh, I know. That's, you know, that's something we've talked about. We're like, hey, this is a great time to go out there and pitch around and say, hey, yeah, if you want to put some money to Bitcoin mining, this is probably the time to do it. Because, I mean, when I bought my What's Miner, I think I got it for $8,800. Mm-hmm. And that was through Kaboom Racks. And it, like, they're relatively, I mean, it's not a huge discount, but they're relatively just like slightly cheaper than what you could find if you're just Googling around. But I remember, I think they were going for like $9,500 at the time. You know what? Last December, November, they were probably closer to 15,000, right? Like yeah. 100 terahash machine was probably like 13, 14 grand. Now you can get it for like $5,000.
Probably even less, yeah.
And so it's just, I'm curious. I mean, it works for me because I bought it with Bitcoin. So like, I look at it as I was like, oh, like it actually, I got a better deal because yeah. I would have had to sell more Bitcoin now than I did up at the higher price. But, you know, whenever you have expenses in fiat and every, you know, not everything's in Bitcoin, that could be a problem. I could see that. I mean, right now it feels like mining feels like, I was like, oh, I just bought a really expensive DCA machine. Like, oh, it's my dollar cost average, you know,
yeah.
with like a 20% discount or something like that, which still is good. You know, granted it feels like it's a lot further off, of a ROI, but I'm not, you know, as concerned with that. I knew I was getting into, and I also know, like, you know, we're what, year and a half, like 18, 19 months away from the halving, you know, so it's like, hurry up and stack as much as you can now, because look out.
Have you guys noticed how exchanges are going insolvent and they're losing keys left and right? I've noticed, and that's why I have a Bitbox O2 hardware wallet. And that's why I recommend that you get a Bitbox O2 hardware wallet. And that's why I think a Bitcoin-only wallet is the way to go. Go to shiftcrypto.ch/BitcoinMadeSimple. Use the promo code BitcoinMadeSimple to get 5% off. And you can get yourself a Bitbox O2 hardware. Yeah, a lot of Bs. So I'm just going to keep that in there because I do these naturally. Get a Bitbox O2 hardware wallet. It is easy to use. I mean, it's a touch screen. It's about the size of a thumb drive. There's a touch screen on it. Very easy to use. Secure your own keys. If I can do it, anyone can. And as Luke always says, it's sleek and sexy. So you'll like it. You'll be happy you bought it. And it'll be the best way to give yourself peace of mind when you go to bed at night, knowing that your keys are secure and in one place and not being rehypothecated by the exchanges. So get a Bitbox O2 hardware wallet from Shift Crypto. Go to shiftcrypto.ch/BitcoinMadeSimple. Use the promo code BitcoinMadeSimple to get 5% off.
Do you have any tips
for home miners, first time home miners, that, you know, when they're getting into it, because I've tried to really relay some, but I haven't done it. Do you have any operating at your house?
Not right now. I don't know. Not at my house.
Well, I guess you have access to better energy. So,
yeah, it would be my commercial rates are pretty good. So, I've got a lot of miners, that I possess, but they're running in my commercial operations. Yeah. I do have, a little USB one, that I got to fire up. But advice to people, first, I really like the way that you thought about it. I think that's a very advanced thought process. And that's that, hey, you acquired the equipment for, let's say, I'll just use a number, right? It costs you 0.15 Bitcoin to buy your miner. Okay. Mm-hmm. And now that same miner might cost 0.2 Bitcoin. Therefore, mm-hmm. you did better, right? I mean, that's a great, I think, step in thinking in Bitcoin instead of thinking in fiat.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great way. Very few people would have advanced, I would say, to thinking that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, when I talk to people a lot, I'll say, you know, the language of money, we're all monolingual. You know, we've been, you know, our native tongue is dollars.
Yeah, around the world, everybody just says dollars. It doesn't even matter what your currency is.
Right. And they, even if they have a local currency, my wife right there, she's Filipina. And if we're in the Philippines and we're walking down the street in some market and there's a guy selling flip-flops and it says 50 pesos, you know, I can give him a dollar and he instantly knows that 50 pesos is a dollar. Like, I mean, he knows that.
He knows. Yeah.
And he'll accept the dollar. So the language of value and wealth in the world is dollars. And so I think, you know, where I am, I think where you are, you know, those of us that have been around a while, we start learning the second language of money, and mm-hmm. and the more, like, being in the mining business helps you a lot. When I evaluate new mining opportunities, I present it to investors. I always present both a dollar pro forma and a Bitcoin pro forma, mm-hmm. and I'm trying to push them actually as much as possible to think in Bitcoin terms. So that's one thing. So as miners, think in Bitcoin as much as you can. Second thing, just like when I give advice to people about buying Bitcoin,
mm-hmm.
I always tell them, you know, look at a 4-year horizon at least, you know, lock it mm-hmm. up for 4 years. I'll tell mining people exactly the same thing. Like, you've made the commitment. If you get into it, you've made the commitment to it. Buy relatively recent technology. You know, you bought an
M30S++.
Yeah. So, you know, buy technology like that if at all possible. I mean, if all you can afford right now is an S9 and you just want to play, don't look at 4 years. Think mm-hmm. of that as education. That's an educational opportunity.
It's a $300 or $400 education machine. Yeah.
Yeah. That's put that in that bucket. If you decide you want to be in the mining business at whatever scale, you need to buy that technology. You need to be buying those 100 terahash per second class or better products right now and look at it in a 4-year window. And, you know, I started in this business in 2017, and not long after we started, we kind of went into a 2+ year winter, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had people, and we don't do as much as we used to. We still host a little bit for others, but and that when we first started, we were primarily hosting for other people. And I had people, let's say, put $50,000 in. Let's just call it January 1 of 2018, roughly, put 50 grand in. And I had to do some therapy sessions and some coaching, but as we were going through 2018, 2019, and it was very marginal, right? Like mm-hmm. you said, very, very similar to today. Like, and even on some months, they might say, I lost money this month. I said, no, you didn't. You just got to look at it differently, you know? Mm-hmm. And, the people that never panicked, the people that stuck with it by the early part of 2022, so basically 4-year cycle,
mm-hmm.
50,000 was worth a million. The guys that stuck with it, never sold. They just paid, in my case, they're paying me a hosting fee, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the guys that stuck with it, they 20x their money. So I'm not telling you that that's what's going to happen to you if you do it today, but there's a chance, and it's not like a 1% chance. There's a real chance that you get that same thing.
Yeah. And if we all know where the prices of Bitcoin is going to go eventually, you know, if you look at a long enough time horizon, you know, it's like, oh, this machine's only making me 20 bucks a month. Like, well, that's a bummer.
Yeah.
And then next thing you know, you wake up one day and go, hey, honey, guess what? We're retired, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, also don't panic, because the system's always kind of, as a miner, the system's always supporting you a little bit. Mm-hmm. Because if price stays down on a sustained basis, then the hash doesn't grow. So you get more Bitcoin. So I have different pro formas, right? So when I'm looking at a business opportunity, I run several scenarios. Again, I have my own global hash rate predictor.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'll say, okay, if price is, like right now I'm looking at an October startup of a new site.
Mm-hmm.
And I have what I would call a low pro forma, where the price is in the low 20s in October.
Mm-hmm.
And then I look 4.5 years out. That's my normal window for mm-hmm. one cycle of a mining machine. And let's say I have, like in that one, I have 92,000. So I think it's a very moderate, you know, we over the course of the next 4.5 years exceed the previous high, but only by a little less than 50%, right? So mm-hmm. pretty, in my mind, pretty conservative. So no, there's another scenario that by October we've rebounded to like the low 30s, and at the end of 2027 the price is at like 262, I think is the way that model works. What's interesting though is that the first, and there's one in the middle, the first model generates significantly more gross Bitcoin, because at that price band over that time period, less global hash rate comes in. And because every machine I own, if I run it over that time period, we'll just take it. It's not that big. Obviously, it's not that huge operation. But let's say that operation in October represents 1% of the world's hash power. Well, I'm going to get 1% of the world's Bitcoin mined in that month. And then I expect it to grow, but it's going to slowly decline as time goes by. And we're going to have the halving in that cycle. But at the end, in 2027, at the end of the cycle, when we expect to decommission the machine, the global hash rate is lower. Therefore, we still own a larger percentage of the world's hash rate in 2027.
Hmm.
But it's at 92,000, right? But in the second scenario, the high scenario I talked about, you know, again, we started about 1%.
Mm-hmm.
Starting point's the same. But at the end, we possess, I'm going off the top of my head, so, but I think it's something like half as much hash as we would in the first scenario, but the price is 3 times better. So mm-hmm. it's still better. The high scenario is still better than the low scenario, but the low scenario is not as bad as you think it is.
Yeah. You end up with more Bitcoin.
Because you end up with more Bitcoin. Right.
And if you're looking on the long time horizon, that's always better.
Yeah. Yeah. So the other thing that I'm working on, actually, I got to bring a mathematician on staff because I've done some of this work in the past. But the other thing about Bitcoin is my models, in all honesty, it's not exactly a linear growth in price and a linear growth in hash. I've got some variability, but it's impossible for me to predict when the downturns will be, right? So we have two endpoints and there's a curve upon which we get to that endpoint. But the reality is going to be, I mean, anybody out there listening is going to know this by now, right? That let's say we start at 25,000 in October and we're marching toward, we'll just keep it simple, 100,000 in 2027. Well, we're not going to get there by growing whatever the math would be 1% per month to get there, right? Price is going to go up. It's going to come down. It's going to stay down there for 3 months. It's going to spike, may spike up to 140. Then it'll be back here. It ends at 100. That's the way it would really get there. Well, those troughs, I'm not talking about short spikes, but what I would call a trough, those are great opportunities because you see anybody that has an inefficient operation in today's world, you know, we've seen the S9s, you know, I believe largely come offline now, right? They're, you know, they represent at the beginning of the year, 20, 22% of the hash rate. I don't know the exact number, but it's probably 1-2% now.
Oh, really?
It's really
just in this year.
Yeah. Well, you can run the numbers. You can run the numbers. I mean, at 23,200 exahash-ish sort of global hash rate, they don't look so good.
Yeah.
You know, no. And so, you know, somebody, any sort of commercial operation using them, you know, that's you know, that's beyond it. As I said, you know, there's probably some plebs who want some non-KYC Bitcoin. It's fine. And it's the essentially the they're paying a premium for the Bitcoin they're getting. And then there's this educational thing, right? People that just want to learn and be part of it. But yeah. I think that's the S9-ish class stuff now. But under normal circumstances, I think you always have 20 to 25%. There's always 20 to 25% of the hash rate that's kind of older technology at higher energy prices, right? There's always going to be. And so
always going to be stuff phasing flex. Out.
Yeah. And it'll flex, right? Those machines, they're off right now. If 2 weeks from now, we rebound to, let's say, 35,000 as the Bitcoin price, we probably see 5-8% of the hash that was in those S9s get turned back on. People dust them off, they put them on. But what'll happen is the big commercial guys have probably started decommissioning. So if you're a commercial miner, you start boxing those up, you're trying to sell them back into the market, and you're plugging in, and you've probably already plugged something else in, right? Now the problem with the S9s though is it because you have to reconfigure it, right? Because the S9's like a 1,000-watt device, and if you're going to go put an S19 or an M30 or something like that, now you're plugging in a 3,000-ish watt thing. So, you know, you may have had to do some rewiring, change your breakers, you know, do some of that sort of stuff. Hence, you're not going to put the S9 back in, even if you had it there. You got something better cranking there now. So, So I'm probably way off on a tangent than what you even asked me. I don't know.
I'm like just sitting here absorbing, thinking, because there's just so many scenarios you have to think through as a miner. And, you know, like I look at, you know, the ability, I'm like, oh, one of the, I feel like one of the big barriers to entry is the fact that like I bought the miner and then was like, oh, I need a new outlet to plug this in. Like, I don't even have an outlet that is suitable for this.
Yeah.
And right. And so I had to do that and had to you know, pull that electricity, you know, have them have an electrician. I mean, I think it cost me like $400 to have an electrician come in and do everything. Cause I was like, I'm not messing with that. Like now that I have the new outlet, like my brother-in-law who is an electrical engineer, he was like, I don't like going into the breaker. He's like, but now that it's off the breaker, he said, I know what to do. He's like, so I can, you know, he's like, I can do it, you know, up to code and everything like that. And I was like, okay, good. But, you know, if there was a way to take, I think I saw Adam O put something out where he was like, there's probably a few Bitcoin to be earned by somebody that could come up with a way to take, like, take a current S19 or something, break it down and take the boards of the ASICs and turn them into like machines that could just get plugged into a regular outlet.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's I think that's a lot of work. I agree with the market need, though. I don't think anybody's going to go through that much trouble. But I definitely agree with the market need that I think, you know, the market needs a home miner that can plug into a standard 110 volt outlet, run off of a 10 or 15 amp circuit. And not, you know, I mean, there's, you know, that will change. That'll be a game changer when that happens. I think that's best done as a ground up design instead of trying to shoehorn and
old products and
an old product. But I'm definitely in agreement with Adam philosophically about what needs to be done. But, you know, it's no different in a lot of ways. I think, you know, Corey, my background's in the personal computer industry, and I started in that in 1986.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1986, we didn't necessarily have to deal with that electrical issue, but, you know, we had to deal with all the usability issues and things like that.
There's a huge barrier to entry for personal computers in the 80s.
Yeah. Yeah. And so if we look at the IBM PC, I think, was in the very first, what would be considered a true PC, was introduced in 84. You know, it took really the introduction of Windows 3.1, which would have been 93, I believe. Maybe 92. To change the usability to where, you know, it went from a business tool used by, you know, professional people, very specific things. We only had a handful of, you know, software out there that we could use. You know, if you were an accountant, you used like VisiCalc. If you were somebody in journalism or something like that, you learned how to use WordPerfect. You know, that was all pre the Microsoft suite. But once we had the GUI, once we had things, it was still not super easy, but that changed it, right? And then Windows 95, obviously in 1995, was the game changer. But that was an 11-year window, and I think we in the Bitcoin industry could probably expect that we're, I don't know, two, three years away from maybe a dramatic change in not only the hardware construction, but, you know, the setup construction and the maintenance and those sort of things, because, you know, it doesn't have to be as hard as it is, but, you know, they're somebody putting the right time and effort, but the competitive forces haven't been there to date to make that happen. We got two companies in reality, right? One offshoot of the other. And
Which one's an offshoot of the other?
MicroBT is an offshoot of Bitmain.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. There was a falling out. You know, I think it goes back to the block size wars period.
Is MicroBT or is Bitmain a big block?
Bitmain.
Bitmain's a big block.
Bitmain was the.
Which one do you prefer out of the two?
Probably MicroBT.
That's what Steve Barber said, and that's what I bought because him, I think Atomo, Hoddle Tarantula, they all said MicroBT, get a Wetz miner.
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, too, we also are the distributor for a company called Bitfury, which is a smaller player. They're a large European company. I mean, I mentioned that to you. Mm-hmm. They honestly, in terms of construction and reliability, performance and hot conditions, all those things, they're actually the best, but their energy efficiency is not nearly as good as the other two. So, there's always trade-offs. Like in their case, it's cheaper to buy them, lower cost of capital for the same, like to buy 100 terahash per second system, they're cheaper, lower upfront costs, much more reliable, much more easy to service, work better in hot weather, but consume more energy per terahash. So, you know, it's a trade-off. I think, though, legitimate competition, which as Intel chips become more prevalent, very much like the PC industry, you know, that will change.
Yeah, it'll change the way everybody.
Yeah, because it will allow others to come in, design systems in different manners. So, for instance, like I am, I'm a professional. I've been doing, you know, computer design since 1986. I think they're designed like crap.
Miners,
the shoebox design. I think they're designed really poor for serviceability. You know, these. It's just kind of classic monopoly behavior, from or maybe in this case oligopoly behavior, where they're really not forced. These companies, MicroBT and Bitmain and even Bitfury, they've sold every single product they could produce for the last 2 years without even a worry. In fact, they had them all pre-sold, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, what incentive is there
to make them better,
make them easier to use? And their big customers, by the way, don't care about the things we're talking about. Like, well, they care about serviceability, but they don't care about ease of use and configurability. They have technicians. They assembly line this stuff. We even do that, right? You know, that we're big enough to do that. Like we get a batch in of 100 servers or something like that. You know, we literally will put them on a production line. We have a little production line, and we'll get them all configured, kind of in mass. And you know, we'll have qualified technicians that know what they're doing, and they have very specific instructions. We know what pool we're going to register with, and it's all pre-done, and you know, boom, we're in. The average guy who's buying his first one, though, like it's the, you know. You've experienced it, right? You'd be better off, more qualified to talk about that than me. It's not unachievable, but it's a pain in the ass. And you know, I know plenty of people who spend days trying to figure it out to get it running the first time.
Oh, and then once you do get it running, it's like, you're like, whoa, my God. Oh, my God.
The reality of that.
Yeah. You had to get used to that sound. It like stressed me out for like 48 hours. I was like, I can't keep this thing on if it's going to keep me this stressed. And then I got used to it. And then we put it, I keep it in low power mode right now. I'm trying to test to see if it's more profitable that way. I think it actually might be. So it's just
certainly in a, I remember right. Yours are in your basement. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So, especially this time of year, probably not a bad decision.
No, and I'm gonna put them. Do you have advice on? You might not have any HVAC advice, but I'm gonna put them into my HVAC system for the winter.
You want to recirculate? You want to recirculate that?
Yeah, so I'm thinking I was gonna just like after the blower, I was gonna just cut it in there, but Steve Barber was like, like you'll be fighting
Yeah.
the air pressure. He said you probably want to cut it in
On the
before
other
the
side.
blower.
Yeah, I'm not Mr. HVAC. I'm just speaking as an engineer thinking about that. I think Steve would be right. And
Is
in
that
that area, I
because
would defer to Steve. I'm an electrical engineer, computer science guy, and Steve's a mechanical guy.
yeah, he's
So
a mechanical
I would,
guy.
he's a friend and a good dude. And so I and he builds the enclosures and all that. So
Yeah.
I would take his advice for sure. But that's what makes sense to me to put it on the other side
Is
of the
that
blower.
because if you have it on the side where the air is going out to the house, it could a hole could like cause like air to be pushing against, like the air would be like essentially trying to shoot out the hole that you're trying to shoot air in.
Well, you're fighting the pressure. Yeah, so you're
Okay,
trying
yeah, that's what I mean. Basically, like
to.
you'd have the air from your miner trying to go in, but you'd have air from the furnace shooting against it.
Yeah, and you're yeah. I mean, if you think about it, as water, it might be easier to even, which would basically be the same thing. Just, and so like
So I'm going to want
where
it
is
to
their
cut
lower
in on the
pressure,
side.
right? Where's their lower pressure? You want to be, lower pressure.
Okay.
You
Yeah,
know.
I think he I'm getting I have a black box coming in.
Oh, great.
He said they're mainly for outside, but I'm going to put it in my basement for the time being just for noise mitigation. And then like out where the air comes out the bottom, I think I'm just gonna duct that over to the duct before it goes to the blower.
Yeah.
And I told my wife, I said, this could significantly bring our heating bill down. 'Cause
Yeah.
like just from the one, I'm like when I initially turned it on, I'm like, I don't know how one of these can't heat an entire house. Like, we put two on.
I don't know exactly how big your house is and how far you're trying to or how much air you're trying to move, but it could. And that was kind of bring it back to Bitcoin a little bit too. Satoshi, his original vision, there's a couple interesting things. I've studied this. Satoshi's original vision, he really never uses the word miner, by the way.
Yeah, what does he call it?
Calls it proof of worker.
Yeah.
And his concept, that's the term he used. And a proof of worker, the machine or the person, his vision was people had them in their houses. It replaced, he the term he used was baseboard heat. Like he talked about baseboard heat, like replacing baseboard heat, which is kind of an interesting thing because it's not as common in the US, more of a Europe. I don't know if that was
Yeah.
a sleight of hand by him
Yeah,
or
try to
her.
like throw people off the scent.
Yeah, but it was also the miner, what we would call the miner and the node were one unit, typically. So he assumed basically, every miner was a node and every node was a miner, is the way it was typically, the way he typically referred to it. So I think his vision. I think he knew, if you read some of it, I think he envisioned that, these data centers could come up, but I think he viewed the network primarily being tens of thousands and millions of individuals running these things in their house. And then, back to your point,
Heating their house
they
and
would do it also because of, this benefit that they could justify doing it because they were saving this money on heating too.
Interesting. It's a fascinating topic. I mean,
Yeah.
it's like the rabbit hole within the rabbit hole. Like,
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
you go down the Bitcoin rabbit hole and then you're like, oh, there's this other one over here. Let me check that out. It can't be that deep. And then you're like, whoa. I'm tripped all the way down. Well, Bob, I could keep going. But we'll have to do this again. I know we've done it before multiple times, but I know that the audience really appreciates the Bitcoin mining insight. And like I've said before, as soon as I said, "Hey, I'm getting into Bitcoin mining and I'm going to talk about it more on the podcast," I had hundreds of messages of people saying, "Hey, I'm really eager to hear, I want to like, I'm thinking about it myself, So it's if this bumbling idiot here can get walk it, stumble his way through it, then everybody can do it." But yeah, where could people learn more about what you're doing and what your company's doing and
They can
follow
learn
you?
about the company, Barefoot Mining, at barefootmining.com. There's a Twitter account, at Barefoot Mining, which is the company account. My personal account is Boomer underscore BTC on Twitter. Look us up there, and if I can help somebody out there a little bit, my DMs are open. I do my best to help people if I can.
Yeah, ignore all the how's your trade goings and
Yeah, well, apparently a whole bunch of people want my help with USDT right now.
yeah, I've noticed that. Yeah, a lot of college kids that need money for the funniest comment was somebody tweeted and said, I've seen a lot of the people that look like they're in our DMs at the conference. Maybe they're all real.
Well, ironically, you can't see my wife is Asian, so it is kind of a funny thing that of all things, like
That should be the joke that that's how
I'm
you met
married to a
her.
hot Asian lady, so I'm
That's
already blessed that way. So
awesome. Oh, Bob, well, thanks so much for coming on, and I look forward to doing it again.
yeah, thanks, Corey. Good to see you.
Thanks again to Bob for coming on, and thanks again to the BitBox O2 hardware wallet from Shift Crypto. I will talk to you guys next time.